Welcome to BMW The Edge and welcome to the Melbourne Writers' Festival on a kinder evening than we've been having in recent times, I think. My name is Margaret Simons. I'm a journalist, which is probably the most important reason why I'm here tonight. I'm also director of the Centre for Advanced Journalism at the University of Melbourne. And it's my pleasure tonight to be chairing this discussion. But before I do that, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders past and present. We believe that respecting the rights and contributions of Indigenous peoples is an integral part of international development. Best not to neglect the issues at home before we move to a wider world. The session that you're attending tonight, One Just World, is part of a national forum series, which is a partnership between the Australian Government Agency for International Development, AusAID, the International Women's Development Agency, World Vision Australia, and a university in each state, and tonight it's my university, the University of Melbourne. And of course, tonight's forum is also part of the Melbourne Writers' Festival, so thanks to the festival for hosting this forum. The idea behind One Just World is to provide a platform to begin discussion about important development and human rights issues and how they might be addressed, and perhaps most importantly, to be the beginning of discussions and action. We're hoping that tonight's discussion will give you some ideas as to how these issues concern you and how you can make a contribution. Now, before we get started, there's a bit of housekeeping to do. I'm sure you're all well behaved enough to have your mobile phones switched to silent already, so I needn't remind you to do that, need I? But don't switch them off, because if you're on Twitter tonight, we will also be having a continuing conversation on Twitter. The hashtag for that discussion, hashtag one, that is the numeral one, JW for Just World. And if you want to follow the event's organisers on Twitter, that call sign is at One Just World, only in that case the one is actually spelled out, not the numeral. If you've lost track of those details as I've given them, they are also on the forms that you should have found on your seat when you came in. Also, before we get going, you may be wondering about this empty chair here. That is part of a campaign by Pen Melbourne to recognise writers who are imprisoned, tortured, threatened, attacked or exiled for the peaceful practice of their professions, the sorts of writers who can't attend writers' festivals, for example. This year, the empty chair is linked to specific writers who are currently under threat, and the writer featured in this panel is Syrian journalist Mazen Darwish. The Air Force's intelligence service arrested Darwish as a leading member of the Syrian Centre for Media and Freedom of Expression on 16th of February this year. And since then, he's been held incommunicado and we don't know where he is. Penn is concerned that he's probably going to be brought before a military tribunal. Such tribunals are held in secret and the defendant can't even have their lawyer to represent them. So the chair is for Mazen Darwish, and we should also, I think, realise that there are many humanitarian workers around the world and many journalists who face very similar threats in the course of carrying out their work. But tonight we have three extraordinary participants to discuss the ins and outs of the role of media and communications in international development. I'm going to introduce the guests all together and then ask you to welcome them as a group. On my far left, we have Andy Carvin from National Public Radio in the United States, who's one of the festival's international guests. Andy is widely known as a Twitter journalist, which may sound like a strange thing, but he is actually responsible for what I think is one of the most interesting and exciting developments in journalistic method in recent time. He covered the Arab Spring by Twitter, broke news using that. He's also a founding director of the Digital Divide Network, which is an online community of more than 10,000 internet activists who are working to bridge the digital divide. His Google Plus profile reads, "I tweet revolutions." Then next to Andy is Dominic Frigoletti, who is head of ABC International Development, which means Dominic is coordinating the ABC's relationships with fellow broadcasters, media-related organisations and donor agencies worldwide. He's been responsible for the development of new media initiatives with state and federal agencies, and he was also earlier this year awarded a medal, which he is wearing the ribbon for from the Cambodian government. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that's all about. I'm hoping he will later. And then immediately to my left is Cedar Douglas, who is executive producer of Radio Australia's Khmer Service. Cedar's radio career has spanned 20 years. She's been a broadcaster with Radio Australia since the inception of the Khmer broadcasts in 1992. Before that, she worked as a community health educator with various health agencies in Australia, as well as in a refugee camp in Thailand, and she was herself a resident in that refugee camp. Now, I'd just like to reflect a little bit on the context for tonight's discussion. It's often said that we are living in a world in which almost anyone can publish for the first time. Certainly in a country like this, we have better tools for communication than anybody has ever had in human history before. And we hear a great deal of information about, for example, what's happening in Syria, what happened in the Arab Spring, what's happening with Julian Assange. Almost instantaneous communications, whereas our parents or grandparents would have had to wait days, weeks, months to hear such things, maybe never hear about them. And yet at the same time, I think it's fair to say that there's some media and communications black spots in the modern world. How much do you know about the cholera outbreak in Sierra Leone, for example, which is the worst in recorded history, I'm told, or the tribal wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or regional ethnic fighting happening now in Myanmar? And what about the voices of women, who are so often underrepresented, and even when men can speak, unable effectively to speak? So one of the things that I hope we're going to talk about tonight is not only what media can do, but perhaps what it's failing to do. But I'm going to start by asking each of our panelists to start with just a brief address of a few minutes, outlining what the main issues are. And I'm going to start with you, Dominic. Can you tell me, how does media and communications affect a country's development? What difference does it make?
Well, I believe quite significantly, and although in terms of development and the development agenda, media and communications is relatively low as a priority, but communications is the core, I believe, to all societies and core to their development. It's interesting, though, there has been a bit of a recent shift in the last few years towards media as a development tool. And a lot of the focus on media development, probably since the end of the Balkans War, has predominantly focused on media freedoms and independent journalism and journalism skill training. But in more recent days, there's been a bigger focus on the way in which media can be utilised or communications can be utilised to try and achieve better development outcomes. And that's in respect of the Millennium Development Goals, for example, on issues of gender, maternal and child health. In PNG, we've been working on a project to try and have an impact on behaviour in relation to domestic violence, for example. So it's for us, it's really quite significant, and it's broader than freedom of the press and independent media, but it's very much cuts at the whole heart of, you know, what affects a community and how they can actually benefit by, you know, clearly focusing on development issues that are important to them and communicating that across their culture and externally as well. So I think it's quite critical.
Mm. And before I let you go, just tell us about the medal.
I received the medal this year in April, and it's the name of the medal is the Royal Order of Somitri. So it's bestowed by the King of Cambodia, but granted by Hun Sen. And the medal recognises the contribution we have made to media development in Cambodia. And I'm wearing it out of respect for the respect that they showed me in granting me the award. So we've been there working for some time, and it was we've been working in three provinces, and it was the director of the Provincial Department of Information up in Battambang that actually nominated me for the award. And as I discovered, it took about a year to go through the official processes and I received it. So I feel like I'm wearing it for all of our staff and the counterparts that we work for in Cambodia.
Yeah. Now, Cedar, if I can turn to you next. What difference does it make once you have a free and independent media in a developing country? What are the actual differences that you tend to see?
It's a thing before I start to answer your question. Perhaps I have this question for our audience as well. What would it be like not to have a free media? Can you picture you live in a country without a free press, an independent media? Having you sort of think about this, it helps me shape up what I've been through and what I have been contributing to the country, like Cambodia, broadcasting from Australia to Cambodia. So it's very important because what media in Cambodia used to be, it has changed a fair bit, but it used to be just the mouthpiece of the government. Everything was censored by their agency. So before everything goes to air, it has to go through the filter. So basically, it's just propaganda and government's line. So what, as an international media and being ABC independent, you know, and free, we basically give people the forum to voice their opinion without fear. And also, they have learned through the years. We have done it for nearly 20 years, actually. So we provide the forum for people to voice their opinion, even though it's conflicting with the government's line. Mm. And they have learned through media. They understand the free press and independent media. So that's what it is. It's very important. And it has changed in terms of development project. It helps them to, we go to the grassroots level.
Yes.
We speak to people in the rural areas, not just the urban community, but also a rural population as well. Even the non-literate communities, the isolated communities, the ethnic minorities, people who are actually quite disadvantaged because they are illiterate, they're not well educated. So they are the ones that need our service, and it serves as a forum for them to speak up.
And do the things that they say take you by surprise?
Yes. Initially, they were very reluctant to speak, even though we approached them. But eventually, they just learned because we encouraged them to speak up. You know, we can't guarantee their safety, of course. We have to look at the situation and say, are we putting them at risk by encouraging them to speak up, even though their view might be against the government's policy? But eventually, they just realize that what they need to say and what they need to hold back. They can be critical of the government, but it has to use a proper language and not in a sense that putting the government down. Right. So they can hold the government to account for what they do to the country and the whole nation.
Now, before I turn to Andy, I'm just going to ask this audience, how many of you are on Twitter? So a majority not. So in that case, Andy, you may have to tell me in a very literal sense, what does foreign reporting by Twitter look like?
Well, the basic concept behind Twitter is that it allows you to send a very brief message of about one sentence, 140 characters, and have that get sent to anyone else on Twitter who wishes to follow you. So whether you're logging in on a website or using text messaging or a mobile phone, you've got the ability to share real-time information, whether with friends or colleagues or larger groups of people if you have more people than that following you. The way I've used Twitter over the last couple of years has been to identify who are the major actors in different revolutions and protests, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East, and identifying those who are active online as part of organizing their protests and revolutions, as well as documenting them. And so my Twitter account allows me to essentially embed myself as a reporter within these communities of protesters and revolutionaries, and not only follow them in real time, but as we're trying to deal with the fog of war and separating truth from fiction, I then work with my other Twitter followers who have a whole range of subject matter expertise that they apply to helping me research the claims that people are making in real time. And so when there's breaking news, for example, during the Libyan civil war last year, we had people who were doing everything from tracking airplane routes and shipping lanes to looking at timestamps on videos to see if they matched celestial patterns in the skies from what they could see where the sun was at that particular moment.
So your fellow is actually helping you with research with the journalistic work.
Right, they basically do a forensic archaeology of real-time information.
Yes. Is this new in human history?
Sorry?
Is this new in human history, do you think, this capacity?
Well, the very first newspaper in the United States, the first independent paper, which was published in Boston in 1680, left its last page blank because it couldn't afford a large enough circulation to cover the entire city.
Yeah.
So it assumed that people would scribble notes on the back and leave it at the pub. And so over the course of a week, people would add extra notes to it. So this whole notion of collaborative journalism, citizen journalism, whatever you want to call it, is a new phenomenon because of the internet. They're off by over 300 years.
Yeah. Now, we talked about the benefits of a free media, that the real difference it can make to people's lives and to development. But as a working journalist, and it hurts me to admit it, sometimes there can be nothing worse than the scent of a media pack on a trouble spot. And there's world headlines for a day or two, maybe even a week or two, and then they leave. Is there anything positive, do you think, and perhaps Dominic, you'd like to respond to this, but feel free to hop in, the rest of you. Is there anything positive happening about that? Is there anything in the world that is leading us to think we can expect more sustained coverage of continuing problems?
I don't know, but in terms of what we do and the work we do, We certainly try and encourage skills that are sustainable and you know, journalist and program making skills that the people that we're working on can pass on to others in their own country. So at some point, we obviously need to leave. We hope that when we do eventually leave, we do leave behind, I guess, that sort of energy and that drive and that enthusiasm that you're talking about to make sure it all stays in place. But that can sometimes be an expectation that you have in a very sort of short-term time frame. If you go into a country like Cambodia, now we've been working there since 2005, it's a slow burn, it's a long haul, and it's one of working in with that context and being very attuned to the nuances there. So in some instances, you experience steps forward in terms of development and capacity and the way in which the media develops, and then you get a clamping down. And we're finding that at the moment. And there's the lead up to, there's a commune elections going on at the moment in Cambodia and the national elections next year. So the Minister of Information that we're working with, who is a champion of change, but you know, constrained within his context because he needs to survive as well. He is sort of giving us advice about being careful with the talkback programs that we've set up with the provincial radio stations about opposition parties coming on air and so on, all of those sorts of things. So it's being very attuned and making sure that we are constant with our messages, with our values, with our you know, what we believe in, and being constant in that context, but doing it in a way that, you know, it sometimes challenges your own sense of what should happen and when. And so, you know, it's a difficult question to answer. And often it's not about, you know, going in and dropping in some journalists or some content development advisors and saying, take this pill and everything will be okay, and you'll be on the path to independent media and democracy. It's really about long-term relationship and that constancy. And one of the, I think, the value behind being part of Australia's national public broadcast, the ABC, is that we can maintain these relationships over a long period of time. And obviously working with AusAid, who is really our development partner on all of this, to make sure that we don't just go in, lobby in, create a bit of a scene and a mess and think it'll stick, and then we go out and then it goes back to the way it is. It really is a long-term commitment and to try and reach that point that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I hope I've answered your question.
No, I think you have. And Andy, I think you're tweeting as we speak. That means effectively we are actually connected right now to your community of followers.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Whether they're reading it depends if they're awake or asleep, because I know most of my American colleagues, if they're wise at least, haven't gotten up yet.
And they will now be following the hashtag,
right?
I assume.
But I imagine my followers in the Middle East, it's quite possible they're reading these tweets right now.
So. Yeah, that's probably true.
So we'll see if they chime in.
But is that an antidote to the short-termism of a lot of journalism, the continuing ability to connect, the continuing process of the reporting by Twitter?
It's a potential antidote. You know, having reporters parachute in during a major story, obviously, is important, and it's also pragmatic because we don't have enough reporters around the world to be everywhere at once. Having said that, one thing I've seen in my work over the last couple of years with the Arab Spring is that there was a before period and an after period where the reporters aren't necessarily focused. Mm. So, for example, in Libya, people were talking about beginning the revolution on February 17th, 2 weeks earlier than that. Mm. So there was a buildup online of people who were getting ready within Libya and as part of the expatriate community internationally. And then after Muammar Gaddafi died and the new government took over, a lot of the media left. But nonetheless, there's citizens' media coming out of Libya on a daily basis, not to mention all this new independent media that didn't exist before because of state controls.
Yeah. And Sita, what sort of capacity do you see developing in the citizens of the countries that you have worked in terms of telling stories? What sorts of abilities are they gaining that they didn't have before?
Basically, we work in partnership with key community leaders, local NGOs, because they are the primary source of information. They're giving us lead, and then we investigate the issue. So because we are based in Australia, and it's not easy to try and get everything from Cambodia being fed to us. So we have to be active in that sense. We have to keep reminding them that anything developed that you think that we can investigate, just let us know. And they do that. They even send us the images of the when the Cambodian environmentalist was killed in broad daylight. They did that instantly. So we've got all these, and then we would send our local reporter to go investigate the issue and file the report. We can't be there, but we can use our reporters on the ground to do the work for us.
Yes.
And by staying engaged with our partners, our local FM partners, and also our local NGOs who are very, very active, they're the ones that feed us a lot of information, and also our key community leaders. They are the main source of information.
So for you too, the people involved in the events are themselves the journalists to some extent.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And we also, because they are pretty much citizen journalists in that sense, because they know how to use media. That's how we train them initially. It has taken 20 years to be up to that level. We train them in a sense that when we went there on our assignment, we actually spoke with them. We talk to them. Basically having normal discussion, but at the same time, inform them. This is the media here. It's free press, and then if they feel that they can benefit from giving us the information, and we do the investigation, and they can also provide contact details. If we can't get through to that source, can you actually lead us to the other one? You know.
Yes.
So obviously, we try to get hold of all stakeholders. But it's not always easy, having to deal with from Australia and calling Cambodia and all that. But we do our best, and mostly we get through, if not all.
Is that a relevant concept, that idea of citizen journalism or citizen and journalist collaborations in Cambodia, Dominic? In Cambodia?
Very much so. And in fact, the drivers for citizens to be involved in a local issue and tell that story is much stronger than those who are formally registered sometimes as journalists, because in a context like Cambodia, often journalists won't actually go to an event to cover it unless they're paid to do it. So the whole model of it is different to what we expect and experience here. And what we've been doing in Cambodia is encouraging the take-up of talkback radio in particular.
Right.
And that's why we've been... We started with a pilot with Radio National Kampuchea, which was the state broadcaster trying to make the transition to being a public interest broadcaster, but that cottoned on in Battambang and now Kampong Cham and Kampot, because there was an environment there that was sort of open to that sort of change, and people who are a bit more progressive and not so worried about the need to just make cash from their media. But you've got to understand that, you know, wages and earning in Cambodia is pretty low, so the opportunity to make money in order to survive and just get by is very high.
Yes.
So engaging citizens in that process of storytelling and also about what's happening and what's live in their community is quite critical. The challenge is allowing a radio station that's controlled by the Ministry of Information to allow those discussions to take place is the key challenge for us. And the way we've sort of approached it is, let's start with, and what we did in 2005, let's start with talkback at about agriculture. So it's a topic that is non-confrontational in that sort of setting. And then you eventually build up to, as is happening now, human trafficking, HIV epidemic, all of the sort of key development issues that are important in Cambodia. Yeah.
And what about the response, Andy, this might be something you want to comment on, the responsibilities that somebody such as yourself or a professional journalist has to people who are made more visible and therefore perhaps more vulnerable by participating in media. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, it's certainly been a challenge in the work that I'm doing, because there are a number of governments out there that would gladly have some of my sources killed at the soonest opportunity. These are people who are risking their lives to go out and record footage, to document the number of wounded or killed civilians, to document human rights violations, and to get it out online by any means necessary, or even smuggling it across borders through traditional smuggling routes on little USB keys sometimes. I've literally lost track of the number of citizen journalists I know of who've died over the last year and a half. I've personally known five or six of them. There are probably another 10 that I'm not even aware of, perhaps more than that. One of my closest sources in Libya a year ago last March, he was live streaming audio to document evidence that Gaddafi was violating the ceasefire that he agreed to. And while he was streaming, he was killed by a sniper. And about 2 hours later, as the world found out that he had died, the NATO bombing started. And so he literally died for his cause. And he was the first of many citizen journalists to die since then.
Have you had any experiences of that kind, Sita?
So far, no.
It must be a concern.
Yes.
So what do you think are the main barriers to a free and independent media in developing countries? Is it purely economic? Or is it the action of governments, or a combination of the two? Any of you who want to?
I think it depends on the country. Take a country like Tunisia, which is one of the wealthier countries in Africa and one of the more stable, was considered one of the more stable countries in the Middle East. Yet, and with about 2 million people on Facebook prior to their protests starting. But nonetheless, if you blogged about politics or if you talked about things the government didn't like, you would either be rounded up and arrested or forced to leave the country. From the government's point of view, they ended up being rather sloppy when it came to how they cracked down on online dissidents, because they knew how to block websites and occasionally fish passwords from Facebook, but they didn't realize that just because you blocked YouTube didn't mean that activists wouldn't post video on Facebook or circulate it on Twitter. And so by using the very blunt instrument of either arresting citizen journalists or blocking a handful of websites, it did them absolutely no good. And 4 weeks later, the president was gone.
Main barriers, Dominic, what do you think?
Well, I also think it's about how we define what is free media. Mm. And certainly in the space of journalism and reportage, and it's very much as Andy is saying, but it's a much greater dimension than that. And this is also, you know, taps into the thing about, you know, citizen media and social media and so on, and how media can be used as a development tool. For example, in a country like Papua New Guinea, where we're also working, apart from the dynamics around journalism and so on, you know, we have issues such as domestic violence and really our limitation or our barrier is only the level to which we can creatively engage and actively engage with understanding how communication ecologies work in that context and how to then utilise and harness the power of communication and that relationship with audiences to tackle an issue such as domestic violence. Mm. And we're only learning that as we go.
Yes.
So what you then discover as you're working in some of these countries, whether it's the Solomon Islands or Papua New Guinea or Vanuatu, there's a lot of freedom of media. There's a lot of freedom of communication that exists. Understanding that in context can help free up. That's the stuff that Andy is talking about. And it's about being constant with your own sort of principles and values and guiding that and working in that setting to eventually build up those trust, you know, amongst that those local communities and whether it's governments or whether it's donors and all of that sort of stuff. And that's a really big and a long-term commitment. So I think we need to be careful about, you know, when we talk about media freedom, it's just about journalism and that side of the dimension. It's much, much broader than that. You know?
Yes. Yeah. And is there a balancing act there? And Cindy, you might want to come in on this, but is there a balancing act there between holding true, as you just said, to your own values, but also not simply coming in and telling people what's good for them or what they should want or what the issues are important or newsworthy or to be discussed at CEDA?
It's a balancing act. That's what we feel that, you know, you've got to walk in there. You can't impose something that they don't want. Mm. I think democracy, in a sense that, you know, for the Western world or developed world, democracy is something perceived by developing country as, you know, you have the freedom to do everything you want. It's not true. I can't go and shoot you. That's, you know, I can't go and kick you around or demolish the building. Mm. It's not about having the freedom to do everything you want. It's about law and order, really. So as long as you do everything according to the law and order, and then you'll be fine. But if you start hurting people, then you are in breach of another human rights violation.
Yes,
so I think democracy to Cambodia, I can only speak for Cambodia because, you know, that's how I experience. Mm. They misinterpret what democracy is all about. You know, they can't, they basically, they see the picture that free world, you know, and therefore they can do whatever they want. You can drive on the wrong side of the road or against the traffic and all that, and that's not democracy.
And it's being, I think it's being very attuned to the context, and we're about to start doing some work in Burma, funded by AusAid as well. And that place is moving very quickly. But it's not about going in there and taking the free media democracy pill at all. The focus will be on communications as a tool in rural development. And if you can get communities engaged or active around those rural development issues that are facing their daily lives, that's how you can get that social mobilisation happening and getting that discussion happening and hopefully getting that to spread across communities and across groups rather than going in there and saying, look, we're going to teach you how to be independent, free, free media journalists.
Yeah. Can you give me a really concrete example of how that might work, Dominic? I mean, what sort of difference might it make in the community, the communications skills?
Sure. I mean, in the context of Papua New Guinea, we ran a campaign last year called Use Your Voice, and it was all centred around domestic violence. And what we did was... I mean, some of the statistics around domestic violence in Papua New Guinea are off the scale, so it's quite dramatic. So what we did was focus on some key broadcasters at the National Broadcasting Corporation to be the sort of the champions of change. And there was one guy there who admitted that he engaged in domestic violence with his partner, and that was something that he needed to confront. And he then became a champion for that change and went on the road. And actually, we set up forums. We also, you know, involved... Sport is very important in Papua New Guinea. So we involved the rugby code. We involved Digicel, the mobile carrier, and text messages. We set up community forums and discussions, organised talkback radio. So every dimension of communication and media around this particular issue to get some sort of discussion and mobilisation happening on it. The other key to it is, once again, it's the context, is the research that you need to actually set up to understand the environments that you're going into that will then shape the creative ways of addressing an issue such as domestic violence. Something that we're about to start on, this Pacific-wide initiative called PACMAS that we've got, 80% of all deaths in the Pacific are related to non-communicable diseases, for example. So we're starting to build a campaign around how media and communications can be fully utilised to raise awareness around NCDs and potentially try and change some behaviours in relation to into that issue. Setting up the sort of the research and the monitoring and evaluation to actually find out whether you're having an impact is really critical to that process. There's a whole range of other examples that we've been focusing on as well.
It's fascinating. Now, I'm going to ask you in a minute what the black spots are. You know, where are the places that even in this communications age we don't hear from or we don't hear about? But obviously one of them tends to be women in many developing countries. And I was wondering whether you got women to speak out too about domestic violence issues. Did you, or
yes,
was that hard?
But we discovered from some of the preliminary research is that the target should be men.
Yeah.
They're the ones that we're hoping to try and influence behaviour. They're the ones that in some PNG societies where... You know, it's endorsed or you know, violence is seen as part of the way they go about responding or behaving with one another. So we targeted men in particular, in the whole concept of the big man thing, and that big men don't really engage in violent acts. Previously, you know, the target without the research would have been, let's focus on women in particular, and we did, and help them set up support centres and all of those sorts of things. But really, who is the group that we want to try and influence? And it's actually the men.
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah.
And also, I think certain aspects, women also need to be informed, and sometimes they don't realise that they the one that contribute to... gender bias as well, because in Cambodian culture, if they have only they only have enough income to send one child out of seven children to school, they would pick a boy because they believe that when the boy is educated, the boy will look after the family, and most of the girls would remain, you know, at home or help the family with you know, farming activities or look after the family or the younger siblings. So it is the mindset or the cultural sort of mindset that, you know, women do not need to be educated, only men. And it's sometimes it's just women themselves, the mother themselves, making that decision because they've been through that. That's how their mother treat them. And then when they have their daughters, they do the same to their own daughters without realizing if they are actually punished their daughters for not providing opportunity for the education, you know, if whatever they have within their family, economic, allow them to do it. So in that part, because usually women control finance in the family, they're the one that have a say whether the boy should go to school or a girl should go to school, and then they basically 99.9% would be a boy.
Yeah.
So this part of, this is where the media comes in. We don't tell them what to do. We provide the forum and get women to talk. Why? Why do they choose to do that? Why do they choose to give priority to son and not daughters? They speak up, and then we just prompt them. Don't you think that girls also need to be educated? And why do you think that girls don't need to be educated? Because they need to, when they are married, they will be looked after by their husband. Mm. So therefore, you subjugate women under men's power again, economically, because they're the one that bring income.
Yeah. Mm.
So these things, we can't tell them what to do, but what we do, we set up a forum where we get women to talk. And then when they start talking, they realize, they pick up through that, wow, we the one that caused the problem.
Yeah.
It just keep going from generation to generation. And Dom is right, that we also have to educate men certain things that what they've done to hurt their wives, and that carry on from generation to generation.
Mm.
So.
But it's also about being attuned to that cultural context and not imposing our model. I mean, in the case of PNG with the Use Your Voice campaign, it was actually the female staff, the National Broadcasting Corporation, 100% all experienced violence of one form or another. And it was like, we're sick of this. We're really sick of this.
Mm.
And because it was working in something that they wanted to change and shift themselves, then you have a great local driver motivator behind the media and the communications around and the creativity that goes around a major campaign around something like domestic violence. And they themselves were by and large radio producers.
Mm.
And we started to work with them on producing some interstitial TV spots. They went off and just did it themselves, and they figured it out themselves and crafted some video interstitials that were broadcast on TV, because they were very motivated by this particular issue.
Andy, is gender a relevant issue with social media at all, do you think, in reporting?
I think it varies from country to country. In many countries, women dominate social networks. In the US, for example, it's not unusual for the average social media user to be a woman in her mid-30s, essentially. But if you go to a country like Yemen, for example, where less than 5% of the population is online on a good day, and women have a fraction of the literacy rate as men do, not to mention a whole other slew of cultural challenges, then it's often much harder to find women who are online. But having said that, they're not absent. They're out there. You'll find some who are online in the country. You'll find a lot of expats who are using their position and the relative safety of other countries in order to talk about what's going on in their home countries. And so Yemen, again, is a great example of that. Probably the majority of my sources in Yemen or about Yemen happen to be women.
Mm. Yes, well, certainly in our own country, social media is female-dominated, perhaps the first form that is. I'm going to open it to questions from the audience very shortly, so start thinking of your questions. We do have an audience microphone, I think, so please wait till that gets to you before you frame your question. But just before I do that, I'm just going to ask you each just very briefly to respond to the question, where are the black spots? Where are we not hearing from? Andy, do you want to... are we not hearing from? Where are the black spots in this modern world?
We're not hearing from countries in Central Africa. When was the last time you saw a video on YouTube to come out of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Mm.
We're not hearing from many indigenous populations in Latin America. We're not hearing from certain rural parts of the U.S. You think of the U.S. as a wired country, but there are still entire sections of state like West Virginia where you can't get a data signal on your phone, and broadband access is rather limited. And so the digital divide is not even just a north versus south, but I think it's a very complex issue. And even in our own backyards, we'll often find that there are populations who not only have the infrastructure to go online, but lack the digital literacy to participate and the media literacy to interpret what they're finding.
Dominic, the black spots?
Well, our focus is probably Asia and the Pacific, but it's a big question. I mean, geographically, West Papua is a pretty black zone, I think, at the moment in terms of the Asia Pacific region. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that it may not be so black. Mm. There is a very strong desire to communicate in all of the communities that we've encountered, and whether the media technology there exists or not, it's just we may not hear about it. Mm. I know in Papua New Guinea, for example, the penetration of mobile phones is quite enormous, but communities are using a single mobile phone. So the will and the driver is there, and there's a way of tuning in. You know, mobile phones with radios built into them. The challenge is actually going out and finding out, you know, how people communicate and what drives them around that,
yeah,
to try and form that connection with them. And you might discover that it ain't so black, you know. Mm.
Yes, yeah. Yes, Asida.
Mm. Yes, I guess the black spots happened in developed countries as well, not just in developing countries. Mm. I can talk from my experience that, non-literate communities, excluded communities, rural and indigenous communities, they're the ones that live in isolation, even in this country. You know, the media might go to them, they just shy away. Mm. To break the barrier, you need to keep persisting, you know, like keep trying different way to try and get them to talk. Mm. It's always remain the black spot to medias, because they just, we have to do a lot of outreach work. We might not have the resources to do it, but we have to work in partnership with key people who actually have access to these people,
yes,
to these communities. So, and I think maybe this is the way to go. Work in conjunction with other organisations or key community leaders, mm, to try and reach out to people who are, you know, basically through economic or social situation that they're being excluded.
Yes.
For some reason.
Well, thank you for that. Okay, we'll take it to the audience. If you could just put your hand up nice and clearly so I can see you if you have a question. We've got one from the gentleman in the striped top just down here on the left.
Hello, can you hear me? My question is about media in developing countries. Obviously, TV, newspaper, the traditional types of media part of what makes a democratic country sort of survive. Everybody's talking about advertising revenue disappearing from newspapers and disappearing from radio, disappearing from TV. What impact is that having on the stories that are getting out there and the deep dives into foreign affairs, etc.? And you know, is that a trend that's happening in the developed world? And is that a big issue for us moving forward?
Who would like to field that one, don't it?
The commercial business model that supports a lot of media in Australia, say except for the ABC, which is advertising, often it's not the same in some of the countries that we're working in, or the media markets are very, very different. So you can't always transpose here and the same thing is happening there. And also a lot of the countries that we're working in, the media is often controlled by the state or sort of heavily regulated. So what goes into it and is often not affected by those sort of commercial market models. Are they being affected? Yes, but it's probably more to do with the explosion of new ways of actually accessing media and creating your own media and mobile phones, other online forms and so on is really driving, I guess, the connectivity and the way people communicate and go about their business, and that's happening in the regions that we're working in Papua New Guinea. You know, the penetration of mobile phones is taking over some of those traditional medias. So it's a matter of, you know, organised media or those traditional medias adapting to those new environments and really understanding the communication and the content needs of the audiences they're trying to serve. And out of that, maybe new business models emerge. And that's what is desperately going on, I think, in this country at this time.
Hmm. What's interesting is I think developing countries might be better positioned to make the transition, because a lot of news organizations in developed countries dilly-dallied it over the last 15, 20 years, while technology advances and other changes made it clear that a combination of social media and advertising dollars going away or in different direction were really going to hurt their business models. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, if you talk to newspaper executives or broadcasters 10 or 15 years ago about the long-term, you know, the longevity of their business model, the vast majority of them wouldn't even given it a second thought. So in many ways, I think the problems that journalism economic models are having in developed countries in the West are serving as a canary in the coal mine. As it were, for other countries that haven't reached that point yet. And so perhaps assuming there is enough independent media and freedom of media in those countries, perhaps they'll be able to get their act together better than we did.
And if you see the world as a marketplace, which is, you know, the very American paradigm, and we sort of adopt that as well, especially for international broadcasters, countries like India, there's been an explosion of local choices. Mm. So what does that mean for the likes of, you know, our own international broadcasting here through Radio Australia and Australia Network, when there are so many local options that people living in India would probably prefer over our voice going in there. The same is in Indonesia as well. Mm. So we've got to understand what's changed there if we wish to remain relevant, rather than just pumping this stuff in there and thinking they'll come because it's us. And that's just not viable anymore.
Mm. Sido, you got any reflections on that?
Well, basically the media consumption's attitude has changed because there's so many choices, as our two panelists have mentioned earlier. You know, people don't just stay listening to us unless we offer something different, unless we offer something relevant to their daily life and something that has some impact, you know, on their community or themselves, you know, as listeners. As media, consumers. So I guess, you know, you can say that a commercial sector might have more to offer because they're driven by profits. But independents and public broadcasters have a different role to play. So as long as we remain relevant, providing something that's useful to them, information that is not being covered by other medias, we can still survive.
Mm. Yes. It's interesting. Of course, it's a relevant point in this town about newspaper executives who didn't see the changes coming. But I'll take another question. Okay, the gentleman there.
Hello. Can you tell me, or could you give me an idea of what sort of framework we should use to determine what's an intolerable level of censorship in our society as opposed to other societies?
Can we turn the volume up? I can't hear.
We didn't hear that.
How's that? Is that better? What sort of frameworks should we use to work out what's an intolerable level of censorship, both in societies overseas and in our society?
Okay, well, so the question was, for those who didn't hear it, what framework should we use to determine what's an intolerable level of censorship, both in our own society and in other societies? Is that a fair summary? Yep. Sida, do you want to have a go at that?
I guess it's a very, it's a big question. But I'll try my best. the frameworks, we can, as you know, we mentioned earlier, pretty much that we are not there to tell them what to do. It has to be, it has to come from the people who are actually listening to us. It has to come from people who actually want to know what's going on around the world. And like I say, if we keep forcing people to listen to us because we think that's what they want it's not going to be relevant. So the framework is that building the rapport, you can broadcast all the information you want, but if the government doesn't allow you to be there, no one can hear us. With the social media, with the new media, if people have access to internet, have access to iPhone, of course they could still find out what's going on around the world. But we're talking about developing country where not everyone has access to internet, where iPhone is not in every household. You're talking about the remote, the poorest. Country. So therefore, you have to work with the government in a sense that you need access to feed the information to them. So therefore, we have to be politically sensitive, but not to the point that we have to compromise our editorial principles. It's not an easy thing to do, and it's a balancing act again that we have to adopt.
Yeah. Andy, could you reflect on that with specific reference to social media, perhaps?
Well, before I do that, I just want to say there are NGOs out there that do this on an annual basis. Freedom House, Reporters Without Borders, the Index on Censorship. There are groups out there who really take a look on a country-by-country basis what they see as, they determine as levels of censorship with a whole range of metrics involved. And so Google around for some of those terms, and you should be able to find some of them. Things get complicated on measuring censorship when you've got social media because, like I said before, often countries use rather blunt instruments. They'll simply think, oh, we'll block YouTube and we'll block Facebook, and that'll solve the matter of the public having an independent voice. But then you see people setting up proxy servers, which allows them to get around firewalls. You see people setting up bulletin boards that are run on open source software. And so while it's not difficult to point out which countries currently block Facebook or YouTube, for example, does that necessarily mean they've been able to censor the populations? Well, they have on those particular networks, but that doesn't mean that they've shut them down because people always have a way of getting around it.
Okay, thank you. Now, we had a couple of questions down here, and then there's a gentleman over there. I think, yes, this lady.
Hi, I have a question for Andy. You seem to be au fait with a lot of statistics, and I was wondering, you mentioned what countries we're not hearing from. I was wondering if you could give us more of an idea of, for example, you mentioned that there are some areas of the states where social media is not really happening. Is that not happening in, there would be areas of Australia which I doubt it's happening as well. And can you give us, and you mentioned that women are actually dominating social media. How does Australia compare with, say, other Western countries and even other Asian countries, maybe, say, Japan, such developed?
I have an easy answer for you. I have no idea.
Oh, you know. I think you did know.
There are, like I said, there are indexes out there that compare all sorts of metrics on a country-by-country basis. You can look at data from the International Telecommunications Union, which will give you basic statistics in all countries on broadband penetration, internet usage at home and the workplace, access in schools. There are various websites that specialize in analyzing social media data and which countries have had the highest level of penetration. And so Facebook and Twitter are extremely popular in Indonesia, for example. Does that mean every Indonesian has it? No. But, you know, compared to other countries, a disproportionate number of people in places like Indonesia and Chile and other countries use social media. And so I think there are some interesting, not only infrastructure factors, but cultural factors at play. But I can't give you specific statistics simply because I don't know them off the top of my head and my battery's dying.
There's the gentleman just on the end there. He's been waiting for a while.
Yeah, hi. Some of us have had the benefit of stable industry when we had careers in journalism and have moved into other areas. But what would you say to people, maybe even in the audience, who are seeing these new areas flourishing and developing? Dominic, what you're involved in, the social kind of aspect. How do you build a career in that kind of industry? in that field, given what we're seeing with the industry and the sort of close down of the business?
Well, there's a lot of work in them day hills, as they say. There are a lot of online communities that have sprung up around, say, communications for development and that whole approach to media development. And often looking at a number of, you know, the AusAid website, there's DevZone, and a number of websites that are dedicated to the development community that often advertise positions in media development. There's a couple of jobs coming up in Cambodia that USAID funded project are about to advertise and so on. So it's getting into that sort of development network. You won't see those jobs advertised in the Australian or The Age or Seek. So it's a matter of sort of connecting to the sphere or the sector that is working in that space and getting to know it. Doing volunteer work can often help. And understanding, you know, where the shifts and the dynamics are. As I said, there is a move more towards communications for development, and that means for some practitioners converting their skills. And for example, with the work that we're doing in Papua New Guinea, it's likely that we'll be looking for people that work in audio drama. And because what we're finding is that drama is a really great way of connecting with communities at all levels and seeding social messages in there that might have an impact or change. In fact, the whole origins of soap opera were all around social messaging. And so all of a sudden we're finding that we're looking for script writers or, you know, drama producers or people that can work in that space. And so it's being attuned to that and being attuned to those sort of shifts. But we often advertise jobs as well online.
If you're looking...
Not often, sorry, but sometimes we do.
Whether you're looking for a mainstream media job or trying to get involved in citizens media or whatever you'd like to call it, one thing I would point out is if you take a look at some of the leaders of the revolutions in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, one thing they have in common, they're hackers. They're coders. They know how to write PHP scripts. They know how to install WordPress on servers. They know how to get through firewalls. They know how to set up proxy servers. And you may not think of these as media-related tasks, but there wouldn't be independent media in some of these countries if these folks hadn't done that first. And so I think if you want to start thinking about how to have a career in professional journalism or citizen media over the next few years, please learn how to code.
Okay, we might take some questions. Oh, sorry, you've already...
Andy, you talked about black spots. I was just wondering about a black spot on your doorstep.
Please talk into the mic, I can't hear you.
Can't hear you.
You can't hear me now?
Yeah, just, you have to talk directly into it.
Okay, the black spot, Mexico, just on your doorstep. Have you had much work with journalists there? It's a very dangerous place for journalists to work.
I personally haven't. There are a number of projects. I know there's one that's being run out of the University of Texas at Austin that tries to coordinate bloggers in Mexico who are covering narco trafficking. And among the things they have to focus on is security, because Mexico is one of the first countries in the world we've seen where organized crime and other entities are beginning to torture and kill both professional journalists and social media users.
Now we might try some questions from up the back, because there's some, we've been neglecting the back area. Are there any questions from the...
Hi. Just a question based on the quality of journalism, and I would hazard that a good journalist is someone who balances fact over opinion when breaking a story. Is that an issue when you're looking to develop a free press, and particularly in an area where there's misinformation or a lack of information?
Who wants to have a go at that?
Well, I know when it comes to some of the journalists, the new journalists that I've been working with in parts of the Arab world, the act of being an independent journalist is a revolutionary act. Simply going out and trying to separate fact from fiction and being, you know, straight down the line, unbiased, would have gotten you executed in a number of these countries. And so, by definition, if you are going to be a thoughtful, independent journalist, you've already taken sides against that particular regime. Now, once that regime is gone, that potentially changes, of course. But I think one thing that doesn't change is that I think it's probably universal. One of the main goals of journalism is to hold power to account. And I think you can hold power to account without supporting one particular candidate or another, one particular party or another. But that doesn't mean you don't take the pressure off and hold them to account.
Do your sources expect you to take their side, Andy?
Do
your sources expect you to take their side when you're engaged in
it? It's happened before. I've had sources in some countries freak out when I've asked questions of their government ministers. Bahrain's a good example. It's a very wired country, and you have people who both support the government and who are against the government very active online. So I've had exchanges with their foreign minister on Twitter, for example. And I've had people, not necessarily people in Bahrain, but like Westerners who support people in Bahrain, say, how dare you? What are you doing serving as his mouthpiece? And I have to tell them, well, it's not my job to be either of your mouthpieces. You know, I'm not there to simply peddle propaganda and not fact-check things. And if the foreign minister makes a claim, I'm going to ask him about it, and I'm going to dig into it just as I would with you. And if you like it, go find a press release officer. This is not going to be me.
And in some contexts, like Cambodia, it apart from the danger attached to it, can come down to an issue of it being a profession that can sustain a livelihood. And in Cambodia, young people are not encouraged to go into journalism. One, because it's seen as dangerous, because the parents of those young people now went through a pretty horrible time back in the period of the Khmer Rouge and so on. So there's a sort of fear and trepidation around that. But part of it is working with institutions like the University of Phnom Penh has a Department of Media Communications to sort of lift their standards and I guess the way in which they engage with students that are coming out. The problem in a place like Cambodia is that most of the students that come out of Department of Media and Communications end up going into advertising and working for large corporates because that's where they're going to earn more than $200 a month to get by, and that's in some issues an even bigger one than the risk attached to what you're talking about.
Hmm. And also women in journalism in Cambodia, it's a job that's considered to be men. So as a journalist, you have to travel away from home. And if you're single, you're not allowed to do that. And if you are married, you're not allowed to do that because your role is to be at home and cook the meal for your husband. You can't go away for a couple of days. And if the job entails you to travel to provinces, and that's what happens. So women, even though they might be trained as journalists, they probably end up doing something else, like Dom mentioned. Very few female journalists, pursue their careers and move on to a very, prominent position in the media. So,
Okay, we've got time for two more questions. The lady with the microphone calls the shots.
Hi there. You mentioned before, Andy, that there are some organisations that deal with monitoring different levels of censorship. What I'm wondering is actually within the press and media community, it's human nature that one does have an opinion on some things, might have a natural prejudice or bias. The question is whether there is any sort of body that might oversee, ensure that certain steps, where it's possible, are taken to minimise that and the effect that might have on the integrity, both of the body and the body of journalists in question, that media group, and on the reportage itself?
I think that can get into a very dangerous area. It depends on who that body is. So, for example, the Society for Professional Journalists has its code of ethics, which has been adopted, I know, nationally in the U.S. and internationally probably as well. I'm sure there are a dozen other organizations around the world that focus on the integrity of journalism that have best practices for ethics. And I think it's perfect when journalism associations or nonprofit groups and the like make those recommendations. When you start seeing those rules coming down from government-sponsored press syndicates, that scares me. And so so I think it's great for journalists among themselves and among their peers to have a sense of what's ethical and what's not, but to have a set of rules enforced by a government body, that's a slippery slope.
A relevant debate here in Australia, of course, with the government about to announce its attitude to the recommendations of the Finkelstein report. Do either of you have any comments on those issues, journalistic ethics and government role in them?
I think it's Andy covered. Yeah.
No. Okay, one more question. This will have to be the last, I'm afraid, and I'm going to take it from the back of the room if there is one, because I think we've been favouring the front. But I don't see any hands up there at the back of the room. So it will be the lady down. Oh no, we have got one, sorry. One
also,
that I haven't seen.
We've got another 20 minutes.
Sorry?
We have another 20 minutes.
Yes, I'm going to ask you to make some closing comments, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right into it. Yep. Got it? Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Social media is obviously taken really seriously by some countries that decide to censor it and block it off. But do you think when an opinion is put forward by people here, for example, or maybe in the States or somewhere, do you think it's taken as seriously?
As seriously as what?
As in countries where they decide to block it off because they're worried about what's being said. Do you think here, where there's no restrictions or less restrictions?
Oh, I don't know. I think it depends if an American or Australian says something stupid or not. I don't think the country of origin has anything to do with a person's credibility. A person's credibility has to do with that person's credibility. It's the reputation they build up over time. It's the relationships that they've formed online with people who are also trusted by others. You know, there are people that I would trust with my life who live in countries that have extreme suppression of media. There are lots of people in the U.S. I would trust about as far as I could throw them. You know, I don't think the country is really the deciding factor. It's the character of a person and the commitment they make to their communities, both online and offline.
That's not exactly what I mean. What okay. I mean is if there's some sort of movement, an idea that's being put forward by a group of people and they're using Twitter or they're using Facebook or something, do you think, I don't know, if there's a murmur of something here, it would be taken quite so seriously?
I'm still not sure how that's different from the way I answered it. I think, you know, each country has its different attitudes towards social media and, you know, who's trusted there and who's not. I don't think it really matters where it is. It's the person or the group of people who are putting it forward. So, I'm just not sure how else you would measure that.
Do either of you wish to comment on that?
Not sure how to answer the question, really. Sorry, could you put the question again?
Do we have enough time for this?
yes.
What? How do I articulate this differently? I guess if dissent is put forward in a certain country and through Facebook or Twitter, and then they decide to clamp down on that, it's obviously taken seriously. But if a group of people did it in a democratic country.
Perhaps you might raise that with the speakers.
You mean
after.
They don't get clamped down upon?
How about we talk in person?
Okay.
Yeah?
We might get
perfect.
You to take that up.
Let's do that.
Now, the program says to allow you time for a couple of sentences of closing statement. We could do that or we could take a few more questions. What would your preference be?
I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, I'd love more questions.
Yeah, I like more questions.
Yeah, there are a forest of hands still going up, so ignore my previous statement. We do have time for some more questions, and there's one down the front here.
Hi. Hello, thank you very much. My concern maybe is with a black hole in Australian media. I think that we here seem to start these enormous campaigns that are, for instance, the Olympic Dam. The Olympic Dam was shelved, and all of a sudden Australia, we had this thing that now the mining boom is finished, which means the end of our country. We're going to fall into poverty, we're going to go into the European, things going to happen. And yet when I ask people what was the Olympic Dam, people would think it was a copper mine, it was an iron ore mine. Nobody had the faintest idea that I spoke to that this was a uranium mine or any of the details involved in it. My concern is that these campaigns, they take on a life of their own, and it seems to me there's a whole nother agenda going on that we're not familiar with.
Could you bring it to a question, please?
I'm wondering with what you think we can do to ensure a balanced media and truth in the media that I think we expect, and I'm just wondering whether social media is the balance to this, whether organisations like Anonymous are the balance to this, or whether social media is preaching to the converted.
Okay, social media, an antidote to media shortcomings or preaching to the converted, don't
On, on the Olympic Dam thing, I think part of the issue there is feeding the 24-hour news cycle, and it's a pretty voracious beast. So as a consequence, when a politician or a public speaker makes a comment, the media latches onto every word and then interprets that and then puts it into the public domain to create a story or a discussion or a focus around something that may not have even been a point of focus at another point in time. So I think we need to be careful about confusing balance and partiality and diversity with feeding the volume that, you know, the media volume that's actually required these days. So it comes back to this issue of quality. Diversity and balance and impartiality, it's all there. It's all in that, in the public domain that exists here. It's up to us to determine what we make of the story or what is being fed to us. And I think that's the critical part in all of this mix, as well as using social media to make that comment back and interact with those who own and control the media in this country. That way you get the richness and the diversity of information flowing around a society.
Sita, what do you...
I guess it goes back to the media consumer to articulate the issues. As a media person, you can actually get, you know, comment from various stakeholders, but people actually affected by this should actually put their hands up and say, I want to talk about this issue, and just keep beating the drum, and eventually your voice will be heard. But if a large community, you know, wouldn't give a damn what's going on out there, it's very difficult for media to actually go and get comment from the public. That's how I feel.
Okay, I'm looking specifically at the middle of the room at this point, which is the area I feel I've neglected so far.
There's been a question down the front here.
this lady here. Oh, well, she's sitting next to the microphone, so there you go. Off you go.
Thank you. Is that loud enough?
Yeah, the next one's from the middle of the room.
Okay, Dominic and Cedar, maybe for you this question.
Sorry, could we have it turned up a bit, please?
Oh, I'll get closer? Yeah.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, Dominic and Cedar, I'm interested to hear what community media education initiatives you might be involved in to ensure, for example, that women, in you were talking about CEDA, or the communities in general in PNG, as you were talking about, Dominic, have access to produce their own stuff once the journalists have gone?
In Vanuatu, quite extensive, and a lot of our project work have outreach programs whereby we try and encourage, you know, people working in a particular field or sector to actually create content and put that back into a national system. In Vanuatu, for example, there are a number of women's groups that are working in regional parts of Vanuatu on a number of different islands dealing with women's issues and you know, in each of the communities. What we did there is actually go out and train those women how to record stories and actually just collect the raw information and focus on a particular issue, how to, you know, address a story angle or, you know, a point of focus and so on. And what we did was we equipped them with a very basic digital recorder with the flashcards in them, and then they posted those flashcards back to Port Vila, and at the Vanuatu Broadcasting and TV Corporation, they took the flashcards. When one came in, another one was posted out, and then a radio producer at the VBTC edited that program, which then went to air and got those stories out there. So there's sort of innovative ways that you can actually achieve what you're talking about. And part of that is getting people working in particular sectors, whether it's environment or gender issues and so on, actually seeing how media and communication can be used as a tool rather than just a form of public relation, and actually getting them involved in the content creation process as well.
I think the last thing he said is the most important part, is getting as many people as possible up to speed and how to create content and consume it critically. And I think that goes just as much for every one of us in this room as it does for people in developing countries.
And the great thing about digital technologies is that the process of capturing, recording, is really simple these days. And in a lot of the countries that we work in, the youth demographic is really quite strong. So their familiarity with these tools, which were so foreign to us, and you know, you needed to do a degree at Swinburne or something just to know how to edit audio tape a while ago, that's all changed. And so the access to the device to actually capture the media is a lot simpler now.
Hmm. Yeah. Cindy, do you want to add to it?
There's another way of doing that as well, because we also have partners in Cambodia that relay our program on their local FM. So we also, in the past, we have conducted training for, you know, their producers, how to work with the grassroots communities. And in terms of technology, they know how to operate, you know, like a small Marantz recorder where they can just use the smart card and you know, and everything happen just within hours. They also, we work, actually one organization is called Women Media Center. It's run by women for women. So, but in terms of domestic violence, we know that this is the place that we need to go to. But when it's come to land grab, where it affects, you know, where the community is being evicted to give the land to investor to, you know, for economic development, and then we know we have to deal with local NGOs who actually try to assist people who are actually losing their land and become homeless. So they also train how to deal with medias. So they record a lot of the complaints when people are actually talking to them. They use their iPhone to record, you know, people actually complaining what happened to them, the whole process. And also they send us the images. So all the things form the base of our investigation, and we have to use this, and then we talk to the government, the other party. So this is what the people say. What is your reaction to this?
Thank you. Now this will be the last question, and from the middle of the room, yes.
Just a question about social media. Obviously we've got an increased awareness from governments and corporations. Do you feel that astroturfing and fake accounts is starting to affect the quality of social media? Is it an issue now, and is it going to get worse?
I think social media makes it easier to identify astroturfing. For those of you who don't know the term, these are entities that are being created to represent, you know, on behalf of a particular perspective or something. They seem like a credible NGO or credible group of activists, but they're actually a front for propaganda or something like that. Social media leaves as much of a paper trail as anything else, if not more so. So you can take a look at an entity's Twitter account or Facebook history, see what they've done over time, who follows them, who retweets them, who's liked them, all sorts of little things like that. And so far, at least in the area that I cover, I think attempts to use social media for propaganda purposes have been pretty ham-fisted. The one exception being Bahrain, because they've hired PR agencies to do a very aggressive online push in support of their country. But and then you've got other awkward efforts, like in Syria. What they've done is every time you like use the hashtag Syria, it's not unusual to receive an at reply with the same hashtag saying, did you know we have the best olive oils in Syria? So they're basically trying to flood the hashtag with nonsense. Having said that, though, there is a group in Syria known as the Syrian Electronic Army, which is a group of hackers who do tit-for-tat political attacks against the opposition online. And that type of work not only can be used for propaganda purposes, it can also be used to break through security and compromise people's safety.
Thank you. Well, we are going to have to wrap up there, ladies and gentlemen. This has been the 56th One Just World Forum, and I hope that we've deepened your understanding of some of the issues involved in developing countries and media and the various forces at play, and also some of the fine work that's being done. Now, before you go, I just want to run through three things. First of all, please remember that there is a continuing conversation arising out of tonight that you can follow on Twitter. 1JW is the hashtag, or you can follow at One Just World and keep joining the discussion. There's also a One Just World website, which doubtless you'll find with a Google. The video of tonight's forum and the whole One Just World series is also available on that website, so please remember to visit that, onejustworld.com.au. Secondly, there are some tables in the foyer behind you there from the sponsors of tonight's event. Please take the time to have a chat and look at some of the information on those tables about the work that's being done and the ways in which you can get involved. And lastly, please take a moment to fill in the evaluation form, which you were handed on your way in, or which I think was on your seats, and give it to the volunteers on your way out. That will also be a way to share your views and ideas with the people who've organised this forum tonight. And lastly, I'd ask you to join me in thanking our panellists for their time.